Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Well, as listeners know, we spend quite a bit of time talking around education. We've had different people on the show opining, but I'm delighted today to have someone who's not only trained to the highest levels of academia around the questions of education, but is also a principal of a primary school. So I'm delighted to have on the show Dr. Paul Crowhurst. So Paul, welcome to the show.
Hi there, Simon.
Well, look, thanks for joining us. As I say, you're not only a practitioner as a school principal here in Auckland, but you've also done your doctorate. Actually, what was your thesis in, if I'm allowed to ask that?
I looked at student agency. So that's the kind of capacity that people have to sort of shape this social structures around them. And so that's what I looked at in the primary classroom. So that spent, I like to say I squeezed the three-year degree into 7 years. So spent a long time looking at that particular topic.
Well, it strikes me as a layman is fairly important, is that agency is what drives so much. In fact, one of the topics we should touch on today is around children's behaviour and what's happening in the classroom. But before that, and I know one thing listeners will be interested in briefly, and why I say briefly, because I know you've talked about it a lot, is a couple of years ago you wrote a response, if I recall correctly, to the Unteach Racism, I don't know if it was course or curriculum, and you came under some heavy fire for that. And I just wondered if you wanted to give us a couple of minutes insight into what happened there.
Yeah, it was a few years ago now, just over 3 years ago. I was a little bit perplexed as to why the Teaching Council in particular was launching a campaign called Unteach Racism and expecting schools to follow that. So I wrote an op-ed, went into Stuff, which was kind of surprising to me that they took it, that Stuff took it, because it's not usually their genre to critique such things. So I put that in. And at the time, I was a school principal and I was working about 5 hours a week just teaching a paper at Massey University. And I guess that's kind of where most of the controversy took place, because I mean, I got a lot of positive emails saying that the article was really good. I mean, I guess I took objection with this kind of soft bigotry that I feel like has crept into New Zealand society, where we treat certain groups as victims, and it makes people feel good about themselves, but it doesn't actually do any good for those groups. So I got a lot of positive feedback. I got a bit of hate on social media. Since I don't have much of a following on social media, that didn't impact me too much. A few months down the track, I sort of quite suddenly got dumped by Massey University, who I was doing a small contract with, had been for 2 years teaching in the educational leadership space. And they just said, you know, they didn't want me anymore. And I thought to myself, that's a bit strange, because they've been sort of falling over themselves to get me down there, working on the consultation group for the Masters of Education and all that sort of thing. And in the end, I asked for my personnel file, which I thought would be reasonably light, and it came back with about 169 pages of emails and all sorts of bits and pieces where it was very clear that they did not like what I said and that they did not want me to be a part of their organisation. So, yeah, I mean, the whole sort of episode, which was a number of years ago, is pretty well covered off in a podcast with the Free Speech Union's Nick Han, and people can look that up online.
I definitely recommend it to listeners. It's well worth hearing more about Paul's story. But look, thank you for sharing a little bit of that, because, yeah, the title of this show, right from day one, strangely enough, has been Speak Free. And so, you know, the ability of people to actually, as you did, write and discuss ideas is so fundamental. And so, you know, you and I have talked before in a more private capacity, but it deeply concerns me when people take objection to the level of actually effectively removing your ability to speak, think, act, and in this case, do a contract at a university of all places where ideas are meant to be discussed. But I won't go down the rabbit hole of Massey University. They feature quite a bit in free speech discussions. But turning into education, and I mean, this is an exceptionally broad question to start, but what is the current state of education in New Zealand? We've got a lot of people talking about it. We've got a lot of changes coming through. What's your take as someone on the ground and experienced?
I would say if you zoom out and look at what it means to get an education in New Zealand at the moment, most people should be generally pretty positive. I mean, growing up in New Zealand has always been for a very long time, you know, a great privilege. Coming to a New Zealand primary or intermediate school like I have here, or going to high school, for most Kiwi kids, it has been a really positive experience. And I think we need to remember that, all the extracurricular things around schools, as well as what happens in the classroom, is generally, compared to other countries, you know, a great experience. Obviously, education at the moment has a real vibe of being highly politicized, and that's happening on both sides. I guess right now I would say I have a little bit of concern about like the kind of catastrophization, that's, I don't even know if that's a word, but you know, that narrative that's taking place, that you know, we're in sort of this dire place in education, and often the sort of international testing comparisons are made using PISA and TIMSS and that sort of thing. And that worries me a little bit, because I think it's a really poor comparison to make between our country and, let's say, Singapore or Korea or China or some of these countries that are really excelling at the moment in academic areas, because, you know, we're completely different. I've actually lived in Asia for 6 years, so I have a real understanding of what life is like for young people in those countries. And I don't think we want our kids doing the things that their kids are doing to get the achievement that they're getting. I mean, take Korea, for example. Korean kids, it's very, if you were living in Seoul, be just normal for you to finish your school day at 3 or 3:30 and head off for a number of hours of tutoring in Korean, in English, in maths. And sometimes that finishes, you know, in the early evening. And I don't think we want our kids going down that path in order to, let's say, catch up with countries like Korea. I mean, I think if you look at the last Olympics, it was a really interesting comparison. I think Korea won 13 gold medals and we won 10 gold medals. Well, Korea has 10 times the population that we do. You know, what does that say? It says that we're punching well above our weight in that space. And that's because our kids do all these extracurricular activities, sports, sailing, rugby, all those things that we won gold medals in all those areas are just part of a normal kid's childhood. And I think we don't want to go down that path filling our kids' lives up with academic stuff until 7 o'clock at night. So sorry, that was a bit of a rant here. I think that's how I kind of feel about the current conversation about how we're sort of lagging behind. We don't actually want to do the same things that some of those countries that are doing really well are doing. Yeah.
I think it's actually a really good point. I hadn't actually fully thought of it that way, because you're right, we do a lot of comparisons. I think, you know, the fact that it's being catastrophized is a sign of how politicized things are. It's an old tactic: develop a crisis and then say, we'll fix it. But you're right that if we're going to compare with the likes of Korea, South Korea, I should probably be quite specific, Korea and Singapore and the likes, to go, okay, if we are behind, are we really prepared, as you've shown or illustrated, to send our kids from early morning through to late evening in only education? Are we prepared as a country to drop our well-rounded approach? And I think this says me, as a step parent, the answer is no. Actually, you want those kids developing. But I mean, are there areas where improvement is possible? I had someone from the Maxim Institute on here a few months back talking around New Zealand's curriculum. and the ongoing debate of whether it's rich enough or it's not. What's sort of your take of, well, not only the curriculum, but are there areas that we could improve on, or is it really like it's pretty good overall?
I think it is good overall, but I do think we need a more detailed national curriculum. That would definitely help. The current curriculum, which was first published in 2007, is very light on details. And so what that's meant is that schools have filled in a lot of gaps themselves, and some schools have done that really well and developed really strong local curriculum or local curricular content. I think that leaves like a lot of variation between schools. So I think the steps towards a more detailed national curriculum are really positive. So I would say, yeah, I mean, in response to the question, on one hand, yes, things are pretty good and there are a lot of schools doing a fantastic job and the local curriculum that they've developed is good. But I would say as a country, it would be great to have a little bit more detail, you know, a bit more description to the things that schools should be covering in each of the curriculum areas.
I don't know how much detail you want to go into or not, because always conscious these things are political, but there's been quite a focus on maths, reading and writing. Is that the level of prescription that's needed, or is other teachers and principals that I know of have said, look, we were already doing these things anyway?
Yeah, well, in some cases, schools were already doing those things. I think one of the issues in recent years is that, you know, if you take maths as an example, there's been other issues that have sort of come and bore a lot of weight on the teaching of mathematics, you know, like, you know, cultural elements and so on. And I think that has, I guess, there's been the development of certain pedagogical approaches, that's approaches to teaching and learning, that are not all that helpful for the learning of mathematics. And so I think, you know, bringing it back to the more sort of structured approaches to reading and to writing and to maths, especially in the early years, will definitely have some positive outcomes moving forward. And so, yeah, some of those initiatives being pushed by the current government are, I think, really good for, you know, the future of teaching in those subjects.
I'm pleased you mentioned those elements around mathematics. I mean, look, obviously it's been years since I've been in school. I'm not complete slug when it comes to mathematics, but it's not my strong suit. But when I've looked at some of the teaching approaches and how you're meant to learn math, it's quite foreign to me. I suppose I was drilled, or the rote learning approach, or very structured, but I won't be able to articulate it very well to you, but I was stunned at some of the ways they were trying to explain mathematical concepts. And as I say, I don't think I'm completely stupid, but I was struggling. So it doesn't seem to help the children. And so it does sound like there's some better approaches. Are we developing new approaches, or is the structured approach you reference something that we've done before and we're reintroducing it?
Yeah, I mean, the kind of ideas that are coming to the fore at the moment have been around for a long time. What I would say about like the structured literacy approach, it is more relevant now than it's ever been, because if you went back to, say, when we were at school, there was a lot less immigration at that time. Kids came through with a lot more, when I say came through, they came from early childhood or no early childhood education at all sometimes, with a lot more interaction with adults. And so they had more sophisticated vocabulary. English was their first language. And so using what we call the whole language approach was quite effective, because you were basing it on this really strong oral language base. Now we have kids who are second language learners coming through, a lot more of them, particularly in Auckland. Children below five are spending far less time interacting with adults before they're five. And so their vocabulary is less sophisticated. So the structured literacy provides an approach to learning that doesn't require that really sophisticated oral language at a young age. So it's really relevant at the moment. I mean, learning mathematics sequentially has always been, you know, the preferred approach, I think, if you look at the research. So we're just really going back to the best way we've known to do that. But yeah, these more structured approaches are definitely are quite relevant at this time, and it's good that they're coming in. Yeah.
Just before we get on to some of the challenges that young people are facing, or rather we're seeing a rise, as I understand it, of behavioural problems, obviously more neurodiversity. I just wonder, when you touch about the difference of students, we have a much more multicultural society now, people who are speaking languages other than English first. Is there quite a challenge then to even link back to your doctoral studies, like that the skills required to develop the agency of each child, because you can't just stand in front of a classroom, says me, the layman, talking to 30 kids that all come from a, if you will, a singular or monocultural background. This is a whole lot of kids with different cultures, language, needs. So is developing agency in each and every child one of the key focuses now of modern teaching?
Oh, well, it absolutely is. I mean, and sometimes to the detriment of modern teaching, because there's always been a tension in education and in child rearing and in politics, everything, this tension between freedom and discipline. And education at its best provides some structure and discipline and some freedom and opportunities for agency. Is the diverse nature of our student bodies problematic for the development of agency? I don't think so. I think there's definitely different cultural preferences for freedom or discipline. But no, I don't think it's made it more complex. I just think, you know, because we do get influenced by fads and trends, we tend to sort of swing between one or the other. And I think it's important that we remember that, you know, learning at its best includes both discipline and freedom, structure, and the opportunity for agency. Yeah.
I won't go off on a whopping philosophical tangent myself, because I'm a great believer that actually that discipline and structure rules actually help us develop freedom. But that's a discussion for another day. But, you know, certainly one element that keeps coming forward at the moment, particularly with our young people, and you and I have touched on this before, is the rise of, well, lots more children, young people who are neurodiverse, so things like autism. We're seeing a rise in mental health issues, attention deficit disorders, and so forth. This seems to be very prevalent now, and it seems to be getting bigger. Any observations on what's going on there? Because you'll be facing this daily, I'm sure.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, you've hit on the fact that the prevalence of certain, let's call them mental health issues, has become a massive issue in education and in wider society. There's obviously the big diagnoses that kids get these days. I mean, ADHD, ASD, which is autism, and depression, and the prevalence of those three particular conditions has absolutely skyrocketed. What's also a lot more prevalent is the treatment of these. I heard a statistic not long ago saying that between the end of World War II and the middle of the 1970s, this is in the United States, New Zealand would be quite similar, the number of mental health professionals quadrupled. And then it quadrupled again between the middle of the 1970s and the middle of the 1990s. And who knows how far it's gone up since then. So you've got this issue where the number of people treating these conditions has grown exponentially, and the conditions have grown exponentially. So you've got this paradox that really needs an explanation. I guess our current practice is if a child has these conditions or receives a diagnosis or is showing symptoms of these things, then we treat them with these professionals, whether they be pediatricians and psychiatrists on a medical level or counsellors or special education experts. But the thing that people seem to be missing, in my opinion, is the fact that even as the number of these professionals has grown exponentially, so has the prevalence of these conditions. So, we've got a serious problem that we're not really addressing. In fact, we could be making worse by some of the things that we're doing. I think a really insightful book that I read not so long ago is by Abigail Schreier called Bad Therapy, and she provides a really interesting explanation for why, and it's really well-researched, the book, and I'd recommend it to any parents out there who, you know, all parents, actually all people should read it, is that, you know, we've had a real shift in the wider social consciousness, you know, the zeitgeist of our time, with regards to how we're treating young people just on an everyday basis, whether that's at home, whether it's at school. We've moved away from this kind of moral framework or moral conversations with kids towards more therapeutic conversations, giving children agency in just about everything. You know, I had a really interesting, something that happened really, I kind of laugh about it now, but a few months ago, there was a sports event on the weekend and I shot down there. It was on a Sunday afternoon. I mean, people will know around Auckland, particularly the Weet-Bix Triathlon, and there's literally thousands of kids down there running around, you know, dozens of races. And I was there and our school had a tent set up and a little chili bin with some drinks for the finishers and some sausages. And it was a lovely day. Sun was out and a little toddler walked up to the chili bin and put his hand in and took one of the drinks. And I was looking around thinking, where's this guy's dad or mum? And, you know, looking around. And the teacher who was on the barbecue looked at me and I was like, oh, excuse me. And then dad pops up and I can't remember the boy's name. Let's call him Joey. He said, Joey, are you making good decisions right now? And Joey looked at his dad and then looked at the fluorescent green fizzy drink in his hand and just started to walk off. He said, Joey, are you making good decisions now? And he was following, trying to have a conversation with Joey, when what Joey really needed to hear was, no, they are not for you. And I think that just kind of illustrates the way we're treating kids at the moment, that could be potentially contributing to some of the increase in these complex issues that we're seeing, is that we're treating them therapeutically rather than parenting them, disciplining. I know people are really averse to that word, but talking to them in ways where we're actually providing some structure and guidance about what is right and what is wrong in life. That's kind of my thoughts. Obviously, social media is not good for young kids and devices because they're taking up a lot of their time. They're not as active as they were. Kids were a generation ago, and the work of Jonathan Hyde on social media use is fascinating. He's written a book, which I'm trying to remember right now.
The Anxious Generation.
Yes, The Anxious Generation. Thank you. Yeah, it's a very, very good book. And I would highly recommend it to parents and again, anyone. He's got the statistics to show that as the use of social media and particularly access to smartphones, you know, basically the computer in your pocket, has seen this sort of growth in particularly childhood and adolescent depression. So, yeah, I mean, that's just a very broad sweep just of my own thoughts on, you know, the more complex issues that we're seeing with young people at the moment, really linked into social media, but also the kind of the approach that we're taking now with kids, less about passing on this kind of moral guidance and absolutes that we were fortunate enough to inherit, and more asking them to tell us how they want to be parented and how they want to be
Led in life. Some people who even want to be seeking the permission of your infant baby to change their nappies. There's some who argue that you've got to, and they're not completely fringe, but that because you're touching your child and changing their diapers, that permission must be sought. And I'm a bit like you with a fizzy drink, actually, with a really young person. A little bit of structure, a little bit of guidance is a good thing. But I wonder whether it is, Paul, that we as society have sort of lost confidence in ourselves. Because, you know, my generation, your generation, you know, my parents had something to teach me because they've lived life. And I hope I've got, you know, some experience that I can pass on, in my case, to my stepkids. It's not just allowing the next generation to come through and just recreate the wheel, which seems to be the argument coming through, I would suggest, in that therapeutic approach. And we're seeing the fruits, or poor fruit of that at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the underlying concern from people who, you know, want to let kids find out for themselves and be the ones who guide us is that we're going to damage them if we impose our ideas on them, that they're going to somehow be emotionally or socially damaged. When that's not the case at all. I mean, you know, I see it all the time. Kids are looking for the boundaries, and they're looking for adults to tell them what is right and what is wrong. And there's no shame in doing that. I mean, you talked a little bit about, you know, infants, and I think a lot of this has sort of started with like attachment theory, where, you know, baby knows best. Well, actually, anyone who's had a baby in their house knows that babies don't know best. I mean, there are probably two or three things that could be wrong with a baby when they're crying. One, they might have a pooey nappy. Two, they might be a bit sick and have a temperature. Or three, they might be hungry. And if they're none of those three things, oftentimes they'll just scream and cry for no particular reason. But if you pick them up every time they just scream and cry for no particular reason because you're worried that they're going to become damaged later on in life, then you'll be miserable and they'll be miserable. They won't ever get to sleep. And I mean, that's kind of where it started. We've got this attachment approach at infant level, at the infant stage of life, and that's just sort of slowly gone through childhood and into adolescence. And yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, we have something that in our years of experience as adults that we should be passing on. And if we're not passing that on, then we're not doing our job as teachers, as parents. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned Jonathan Haidt earlier. He did that book with Greg, I think it's Lukianoff. I always get his name wrong, but The Coddling of the American Mind. In their case, that's safetyism, that, as you say, every time a child cries, anytime something's going potentially wrong, you've got to coddle them and support them. And it's like, well, hold on. There's a learning process to be had. But Paul, we better wrap it up there. We have touched on a broad range of topics, so I suspect we'll have to bring you back on because there's so much more to discuss. But thank you for what you are doing, obviously, in the education space and for elucidating a whole number of elements that you're seeing and experiencing in the teaching profession at the moment.
Yeah. Thanks, Simon. Yeah, always a pleasure chatting, and I'm happy to do it again at any time.
Well, thanks again.
Cheers.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you. So connect with us today.